How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Hey, folks. Happy Monday. You are listening to the Woody Overton Window, the WOW. I'm Mike Agavino here with Woody Overton. Hey, Woody.
Sup.
Happy Monday. Sup is this is episode number 17, and it's Monday, August 5th. And we got a lot of Penn State to talk about today.
Yep. And you and I were both frat boys and you know, experienced or share hazing. Then they changed all the shit after my years and everything else. But I'm going to tell you about a story. And of course, we're national, we're going to be talking about Penn State. So where else could America's most shocking hazing case come from but Penn State, right? So two former Penn State students who organized the hazing that killed a New Jersey freshman named Timothy Piazzi back in 2017 had pled guilty to 15 counts of hazing and reckless endangerment. Now, the Beta Pi president, Brendan Young, who's 28, and vice president, that seems kind of old, huh?
He's now 28. Because it happened in 2017, and they're finally getting charged.
Gotcha. And then the vice president, Daniel Casey, who's 27, were in charge of the frat when it staged the drinking obstacle course that left Piazza, 19, dead from traumatic brain injury in February of 2017. So the young engineering student drank 18 drinks in less than 90 minutes and was knocked unconscious after falling 15 feet down a flight of stairs. But it was more than 12 hours before they did anything about it. The alarm was raised, right? So more than 1,000 counts have been brought against 18 members in the largest criminal indictment against a fraternity in U.S. history. The 14 pledges were brought to the frat house on February 2nd, where they were ordered to drink repeated shots of vodka before running a gauntlet while drinking beer, wine, and playing beer pong. And video played in court showed that Piazza collapsed just before 11:30 p.m., but no one helped him at all. No one, they just didn't do anything. He was then seen repeatedly collapsing as he attempted to crawl, rolled around the floor, vomited in his sleep, and went in and out of consciousness over the course of the next 8 hours. And as the hours passed, he was body slammed into a couch by one frat member. He had multiple beers dumped on him by another. And later, he lay comatose while one young man threw his shoes at Piazza. Piazza was carried to a couch a little after 10 a.m., but it was another 45 minutes before they called 911. And a frat brother who was present following that first fall down the stairs revealed in an interview that he was thrown against the wall when he tried to help Piazza. And it's a claim that is supported by the video that they showed in court. Another frat member watched Piazza vomit on a couch in his sleep and texted a few friends about the incident, but did not call for medical assistance or, you know, alert the authorities. And a number of members tried to conceal what happened that night, with one text message recovered by police urging pledges to get rid of evidence of alcohol. Well, the case scandalized America and prompted the Timothy Piazza anti-hazing law, which introduced felony offenses for serious injuries or deaths caused by hazing and has been signed into law by governors of Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Four frat members, and y'all, there's some good, strong Italian names. Mike probably have to help me out. Four frat members, Joshua, what's
Kazuski?
Kazuski?
Not Michael, the Italian.
Michael Bonatucci, Michael Schiavone and Luke Visser were sentenced to between 30 days and 9 months in prison for their roles in the death. I think it should have been wrong. Detective David
Schiavone,
yeah, of the State College Police Department said Piazza had a blood alcohol content of nearly 0.40%, which is five times the legal limit for drivers when he was found. That's you know, your body processes out one drink an hour, so it was much higher than that. The 19-year-old died on February 4th after he was rushed into surgery with a ruptured spleen and a class 4 hemorrhagic shock. Now, Piazza's parents, Jim and Evelyn, have spoken to thousands of students at college campuses across the country in a bid to end hazing, and Penn State permanently banned Beta Theta Pi shortly after their son's death, accusing of a persistent pattern of excessive drinking, drug use, and hazing. And 7 years after Piazza's death, both Beta President Brendan Young and Vice President Casey have accepted responsibility and pleaded guilty to 15 counts of hazing and reckless endangerment, and they'll be sentenced on October 1. Crazy, right?
Amazing how many lives collectively ruined here. Obviously, Piazza, he's dead. Right. And everybody in that house that participated. It's weird, you know. To me, there were so many important things and so many great memories that came out of stuff you could describe as, quote, hazing that we did in college. But this, the forced alcohol stuff, like, people were always drinking in the things that we did, but we never were forcing alcohol down people's throats. And if you look at the way that evening was set up, I mean, you're asking for this kind of trouble when you're pushing that amount. I mean, if he had a 4-point, let's say, because we know that they didn't call the police until 10 in the morning, right? So let's say he had his last drink at midnight, Woody, and they got to him at 10 a.m. And at 10 a.m., he was at 0.4. What do you think he was actually at midnight?
I think dead. So in Louisiana, if you get pulled over and you blow a 0.30 or above, they have to take you immediately to the hospital. And it's technically, if I'm maybe misstating, but if I remember correctly, a 0.40, basically you're dead. Or at least you have alcohol poisoning. So that's a lot. A lot. I mean, I told you one night when I was off duty in uniform patrol, I wanted to blow on the machine and drink as much as I could and see what I would blow. And I was a lot bigger back then. And I drank, like, I don't know, 15 beers or something in a matter of a couple of hours. And I went into the police department and blew on the machine, and I blew like a 0.14, I was blackout drunk. So 0.40. I don't even know how you get that much in you.
Yeah. Well, 18 drinks in less than 90 minutes. That's a drink every 5 minutes. And this is straight vodka that they were making these kids drink. So for an hour and a half on the 5 minute mark, you're doing a shot of vodka. I mean, that's just so horribly conceived. I mean, I'm surprised that more kids didn't get. I don't know if this was a annual event where this was done for years and years, because it's a recipe for this kind of thing happening. And that's just a shitload of alcohol to put in anybody.
It's crazy, crazy story. And they give Greek a bad name for sure.
Yeah. Well, and he falls down 15 feet of stairs and nobody checks him at that point to make sure he's okay.
Froze up and all that.
Scary, so. Scary. Well, from one Penn State tragedy to another, this week we are talking about episode 6 from With the Benefit of Hindsight, the epic podcast that I produced along with investigative journalist John Ziegler and LA sports anchor Liz Habib. That episode tells the story of Aaron Fisher. Fisher became the first victim. He is victim one in the Jerry Sandusky case. And to me, it's a really critical episode in the series because it all starts with this guy. And if it starts with this guy and this guy isn't credible, well, where are we going with the other guys? And so let me give you a little bit of the background here with Fisher. As I said, his story is the one that began the grand jury investigation into Sandusky. It began in November of 2008. At the time, Fisher was 15 years old, and he had been a part of Jerry's charity, The Second Mile, for about 3 years. His mom, Dawn Fisher, she also goes by Dawn Daniels, Dawn Hennessy. She's had, I think, 4 marriages with children by 3 or 4 different men through that series of years. Fisher's mother was amped up to go out on a Friday night. She did a lot of partying, Dawn Fisher, and her Facebook profile shows lots and lots of pictures out at bars in central Pennsylvania around this time. And her plan for the night was that Aaron was going to be joining some other second milers for a night out with Jerry Sandusky that would end in a sleepover event at Sandusky's house. But Aaron had plans of his own for that night, and he did not want to go out with Sandusky. He told his mother that Jerry was, quote, creepy and, quote, makes him feel weird during a conversation that played out in their front yard. And all of this happened in front of their next door neighbor, a guy by the name of Josh Fravell. After a period of about, 10 minutes arguing outside, Dawn and Aaron retreat to the inside of their house and remain inside for about 20 to 30 minutes. Eventually, Dawn comes out of the house alone and walks into Josh Fravell's house. And according to Fravell, the first words out of Dawn's mouth were, quote, I'm going to own that motherfucker's house, referring to Jerry Sandusky. The Fishers live in a town called Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, which is about 38 miles from State College and nearly an hour drive because you're on roads. It's not a big freeway connecting the two. Aaron was attending Central Mountain High School in Lock Haven, and Sandusky was volunteering at Central Mountain High School as an assistant football coach. The following week, so the week after this Friday night when Fisher doesn't want to go with Jerry and says this to Dawn, his mother, Dawn goes to Central Mountain High to file a complaint against Jerry Sandusky, claiming that he's abusing her. Aaron told the Central Mountain High administrators the same basic story he had told his mother on that Friday night, that Jerry was creepy, that he made him feel weird, that he puts his hand on his knee, sometimes he puts his arm around them when they're walking together, and that he's just weird and he uncomfortable around him and he doesn't want to work with him anymore. The school had never received any other complaints about Sandusky, and the administrators knew Sandusky pretty well. Aaron, on the other hand, what do you want to say, Sam?
Yeah, was Sandusky still coaching at Penn State at this time?
No, Sandusky retired from Penn State in 1999. Wow. So this is nearly a decade after he's retired from Penn State.
Okay.
So the school had not had any complaints about Sandusky. And like I said, the administrators knew him and liked him. Aaron, on the other hand, had been a problem student and he was a regular in the principal's office. And he had a lengthy list of complaints that had been registered against him by other students. The school administrators did not believe Aaron or Dawn's story. They advised Dawn to basically calm down, sleep on it, and reconsider, but she was unwilling to do that. She fought them and insisted that they involve Child Youth Services to investigate.
I don't agree with that one way or the other, whether the kid is lying or not. The school has, you know, mandatory reporters and shit. They should have stepped up and done it. And maybe they didn't want to throw shade on Sandusky or whatever. But where did, I mean, Sandusky lived an hour away from the school and he's driving in to volunteer coach. I mean, why would you pick that school? Did it ever come out? Why did he pick this school? He could have volunteer coached at any high school, I would imagine. He was a coach, you know, on a national championship team.
Woody, do you know why I want to learn more Italian?
Why, I go?
Because my niece is getting married next month, and that means a wedding full of these crazy Italians from out of town.
And when it comes to learning a new language, there's only one leader, Rosetta Stone.
Rosetta Stone's the most trusted language learning program, period. I've come a good ways using Rosetta Stone, but it's time to take it to the next level. My niece's wedding will be great prep for a trip I want to take next year.
Rosetta Stone is the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. No English translations. Rosetta Stone helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's designed for long-term retention.
And the True Accent feature is like having a personal trainer for your accent. Lifetime membership has all 25 of the languages for the rest of your life. That's lifetime access to all 25 language courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off.
There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today.
That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 languages for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Hey, everybody, it's Ago. Listen up, especially you ladies over 40. I've got some good news. It's called Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is an all-in-one hormonal balancing solution. It relieves symptoms of menopause. It promotes healthy weight loss and curbs cravings. It improves sleep quality. It reduces bloating and gas. It relieves hot flashes. It can even relieve occasional mood swings, although nothing like that has ever happened in my house. Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalance should take it, but it's perfect for the horrible menopause symptoms that make you put your life on hold. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use code RLRC at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and code RLRC at checkout for 15% off today. Yeah, you know, I'm not sure why it was that school versus versus others. So I know there were a couple of second milers that were attending that school. And so I'm sure that had something to do with it, knowing kids that were there. But as you said, the school has a responsibility when a parent comes forward like that. And the fact that Dawn was insistent gave the school no choice. So they involved child youth services, brought them in to investigate. And a young caseworker by the name of Jessica Dersham was assigned the case, and Child Youth Services worked with a consultant, a therapist by the name of Mike Gillum, and Dersham asked Gillum to sit in on her interview with Aaron Fisher. And during this interview with Fisher, even though he stuck to his story about, you know, Jerry just being creepy and weird and him not wanting to be around him anymore, Dersham and Gillum both felt like there was more to the story and there was more that Aaron wasn't saying. They felt like he was holding back, in other words. And so going on their collective gut, the two declared the complaint founded and an official investigation was launched into Sandusky. So Aaron Fisher, at that point, promptly begins a regimen of near-daily therapy sessions with this therapist, Mike Gillum. And weeks into those sessions, for the first time, Fisher makes a claim that Sandusky has abused
him. Hey, let me say a couple things real quick. So, every state is different. They call it different things, et cetera. But it's not unheard of and actually it's more common than you would think when they first do the interview of the child. Usually it's like in Louisiana, it's just one forensic interviewer that's in the room and law enforcement monitors from CCTV, and they have, you would have a mic where you could ask questions, and they don't have to ask the questions, but if it's something you want to know as a cop. But the, most people are not going to admit it right off, unless they get caught in the act or something like that. A large percent of the kids come, and I know what you think about the therapy or whatever, but we'll come out and say it after they get comfortable with the interviewer. You know, it's hard. You want to say, oh, he put his dick in my ass right off the bat. You know, that most of them are going to do that, especially a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And just on the surface, not knowing anything more about Aaron Fisher than what we've shared thus far, totally buy that. And also buy that both the caseworker and Gillum are doing their jobs and using their instincts, and that Fisher is giving them signs that they've seen before. From kids that have been abused. And so I don't think there's bad faith in the genesis of this necessarily. And so, but after a few weeks, for the first time, Fisher claims that Sandusky abused him. And so they attempt to get a testimony out of Fisher in a grand jury, but he's unable to testify. He's so nervous and emotional that he really can't do it. This is in 2008.
Yeah. And then like Louisiana, those interviews are all recorded. And then 9 times out of 10, like the grand jury or whatever, so they don't re-traumatize the kid if he's actually been offended against, they'll play those videos for the grand jury. If they can get away with it in court, they'll play the same video so the kid doesn't have to sit there until the defense gets up. The kid doesn't have to sit there and go over and over and over again. They call it re-traumatizing.
Okay, well, his first attempt with the grand jury does not create any other action from the grand jury. He goes back again in 2009 and testifies. And once again, he's emotional. His story keeps changing. He's nervous. And same result, the grand jury does not decide to take any action off of his testimony. So the case lingers inside that grand jury for 2 years. And as you know, there's a time limit. I guess it's different by state where for how long a grand jury can be impaneled in Pennsylvania, but at least at this time, it's 2 years.
Let me interrupt you again. I think it's kind of a misnomer on this part. So grand juries it's not like they're there every day or whatever. Louisiana might be like 6 months. They'll do them at a time. It's 2 years. It's unfair to ask of any citizen. What they'll do is the DA will get a bunch of cases, like good felony case, smart case, whatever the fuck it may be. And they get that grand jury in maybe once every 2 weeks or however long it takes to get everybody lined up and get a sufficient amount of cases to present to the grand jury in one day. They don't keep them there for 2 years. They only bring them in once, however often, and do it. Now, I don't think I do not believe it's the same grand jury for 2 years. I've never heard of that. You can't do that. As a citizen, who the fuck?
Oh no, it was. We actually have one of the grand jurors in a later episode that we interview. So it was. Now, it's done
2 years.
Yeah, it's done the way that you said, though. They're not like a typical jury that's, sequestered or stays on the same case and can't go to work for it's right. A certain amount of time a month. I don't know how many days it is, but and that occurs for 24 months. You can be a part of that grand jury, but then they have to reconstitute. So the first grand jury that heard the first two testimonies of Fisher expands, and a new grand jury comes into play later in 2009. But
and let me tell you this real quick too. The grand jury is there for a reason, and if you present your case and they don't think that there's enough evidence, that stops you from. It gives that, and it's going to go to your point in the story, and I get that, but so people know the DA will turn around and go back to the cops and say, okay, now we don't have enough yet. Go see what else you can dig up.
Exactly. And that's what was going on with this case for the better part of 2 years. There's only one person claiming abuse at the hands of Sandusky for a 2 year period while they have that grand jury. But in 2010, with the case with Fisher basically on fumes, they learn about a former grad student by the name of Mike McQuarrie, who supposedly saw Sandusky with a kid in a Penn State shower years earlier. So they are tipped off about the existence of McQuarrie and the story. Ironically, the detectives learn of the McQuarrie incident on the very day that Tom Corbett is sworn in as governor. Not connecting that at this point, but just an irony in this case that it's the day that Corbett becomes governor. As we learned in episode one, McQuarrie is also not a great witness, as whatever his original testimony was to the grand jury did not compel the grand jury to indict. And so these two stories that for the public become the pillar of this case, the boy in the shower, the McQuarrie incident, and Aaron Fisher, victim one, which are the primary stories that created the panic and the accusations of a cover-up and everything else, didn't persuade the grand jury for quite some time. So neither one of these testimonies built up a lot of belief in the grand jury, at least not early. So we know that McQuarrie testified, and we know that the grand jury didn't indict on that testimony. Yet when the grand jury does eventually indict, the presentment tells us McQuarrie supposedly witnessed Jerry Sandusky having anal sex with a 10-year-old boy. Well, his grand jury testimony has never been released. There's no transcript. Even though FOIA requests, et cetera, there have been many, many attempts, the state will not release a transcript of his grand jury testimony. We do not know what McQuarrie told the grand jury, but we know that they didn't act on it quickly. We know it was some time before the grand jury finally brought forward the case against Sandusky. And we know when the public is first told about the case against Sandusky, they're told that McQuarrie witnessed Sandusky having anal sex with a boy in a shower. And so you gotta kind of ask yourself, why wouldn't the state be willing to release his testimony if that was his testimony? And I think we know why, because he didn't actually see anything sexual between Sandusky and that boy. I think we've presented evidence that strongly points in that direction, which I can review if you want to talk about it. But I think we know that because we also know who that boy was, who the boy in the shower was. His name is Alan Myers. He actually wrote a sworn statement that he gave to Sandusky's attorney. He actually wrote back to Sarah Ganim in the paper and in all of those instances prior to the trial of Sandusky. He was crystal clear that Sandusky never touched him that night. Sandusky never touched him ever. And that these were lies that were being told by McQuarrie. Anyway, time runs out on that grand jury and the new grand jury is formed. And somehow that new grand jury is persuaded to allow Aaron Fisher to testify for a third time. And this time he's allowed to read his testimony. Is that normal? Does that happen?
Yes, it can happen. they allowed him to read the statements because they would say he, you know, in the past would try to interview him for the grand jury and he gets too nervous. It's too traumatizing for him, et cetera. And they can let him write it out if they didn't have it on video, right? And one of the counseling sessions or what have you. But yeah, they'll do anything they can to try to stop from re-traumatizing a victim.
Okay. So he goes in and he reads his testimony and Mike Gillum is there with him, the therapist, and he does much better than he's done in either of his prior attempts to testify. And so between Fisher's third testimony, McQuarrie's refined version of his story, and the newly discovered 1998 case involving Zach Constas that we talked about in our last episode. And remember, that case, the 98 case, was supposed to have been expunged. It was supposed to not exist. And so this has always amazed me about this case, is how that is not a violation of Sandusky's rights and cause for, I mean, if a case is expunged, it is supposed to no longer exist. How can something that no longer exists be used as evidence?
I read this and heard this expunged. There, it's like if you get a DWI and you get an Article 894 and complete your probation, et cetera, it's supposed to be taken off your record. And I get that. But guess what? If you get stopped by the same cop or another cop that was there the night that you got your DWI, they're going to still know that it's there. And it's not a violation of your rights. I mean, it fucking happened. The investigation happened. They didn't get anything out of it at that time, but it's there. I mean, you can't take the human element out of it, them going back. I don't think they went in and pulled the NCIC report and said, well, of course there was no arrest. There would have been nothing in NCIC or anything else, but somebody, whether at Penn State or whatever, knew about the prior deal. And they were like, oh, well, you know what? Way back when he had this other complaint.
It was actually, now remember, Penn State has its own police force. It's not Rent-A-Cops. It's a real police department. And they found the records inside of the Penn State Police Department.
Right. There would have been a report written. You don't do any type of investigation without a report being written. But there's nothing to be expunged because he was never arrested. See what I'm saying? You might want to check that. How can you expunge something if there's no arrest? That's what I'm saying. There's going to be a record. If it didn't, the investigation happened, they wrote a report about it. Doesn't mean that it move forward criminally, but I mean, it's going to be there. It's going to be in the files. That it was unfounded, even. So it actually would go to his advantage. We talked to him way back when, didn't think anything of it, but it's in the files. There's no arrest to be expunged. That's what I'm saying. I'm not trying to argue with you. I'm just telling you from the.
I'm really interested in your opinion because it was. There is a correspondence that was sent to Sandusky that he was able to present that was crystal clear that it was to be expunged and there would be no record of it. So there was supposed to be no record of that ever having taken place, yet it still existed in the Penn State Police.
And I'm sure
record somewhere.
Somebody in Penn State sent him that saying, oh, you know, it's going to be expunged, whatever. But you can't expunge something when there's no crime. And look up the verbiage of it. And there's a shit ton of people that I investigated over the years that I had to write a brief summary on, not found it, whatever. But you still have it in there just in case something else happens or another witness comes forward or, you know, something else happens. I don't know how they expunged something when there was no arrest, but I'm not arguing that document exists.
Okay, well, but, I hear you. So those three things taken together. So you've got now Fisher's new and improved testimony to the grand jury. You've got the evolution of McQuarrie's testimony to the grand jury, and you've got the emergence of the records that were supposed to be expunged about the 1998 incident. And with those three things together, they decide to move forward. And that is the foundation of the case against Sandusky, those three pieces. With that, I want to sort of switch gears and move to John Ziegler's investigation and when he goes to State College and when he goes to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, and starts meeting with people who know Aaron Fisher.
All right.
Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay. So because Ziegler's approach from the beginning was to get to the truth about whether there was a cover-up, his investigation was completely focused on the McQuarrie incident because that was the origin of the cover-up. And he entered this entire thing assuming that Sandusky was very guilty, that Aaron Fisher's story had to be credible because he was the first victim. And so basically, his first year and a half, 2 years of investigating, he paid no attention to Aaron Fisher at all and was completely focused on the Mike McQuarrie episode. After a number of these things happen, he decides to go to a State College, and he was finding that so much of what Sandusky had said to him in his combination of in-person and via the phone interviews with Sandusky, that Sandusky was gaining credibility the more time went by because things he told him were checking out to be true, and others involved in the case were losing credibility because things that they told him turned out not to be true, or he was tricked in certain situations, like some of the Scott Paterno stuff. So he was watching ABC's 2020 one night when Chris Cuomo conducted an interview with Aaron Fisher, and he thought Fisher's responses to some of the questions were just really strange. When Cuomo asked Fisher how Sandusky calling him a liar, Sandusky, after he was convicted, gave an interview and said that, you know, this entire thing was started by one young man who was a liar and fabricated all of these stories. And so he's asking him how it made him feel when Sandusky called him a liar. And Fisher's response was, it made me feel like crap. And to Ziegler, that just sounded like a really strange answer for somebody who had been abused 100 times by Sandusky.
I mean, people are different. It's just like the mom says, I'm going to get that motherfucker's house. Then she might, you know, have said, I'm going to kill him inside or whatever. But this kid that's saying, it made me feel like crap. Well, maybe that's a truthful answer. When Sandusky, his alleged abuser, calls him a liar, what's he supposed to say? Oh, it made me feel great. Or, you know, he's a motherfucker or whatever it may be. Said what he said.
It's hard to put myself in that situation, but I would have an unbelievable amount of anger at that individual that abused me 100 times. That person would not be able to make me feel like crap. My response would have been something like, well, F him, that MF is finally getting what he's got coming to him for it.
I understand what you're saying, man. I'm thinking if I'm the victim and, you know, he did me however many times, that is a, you know, you don't get away with it that many times without there being some type of grooming or whatever, and you know, the trust, and you think you love the guy and he loves you, and it's a special relationship, and he calls him a liar. I didn't feel like crap. I mean, I get it, but that's neither here nor there. I'm not disputing the fact. I'm just saying that that's you know, could be a very legit answer. But I have more to say about this, so go ahead.
So Zig doesn't take that as conclusive of anything. He just takes it as weird. And then he says that he's finally got to read this guy's book. He wants to try and understand him better. And when he reads the book, there are a large number of factual inaccuracies in the book, that provable factual inaccuracies that take John from being a little bit suspicious based upon the 2020 thing to now being very suspicious and deciding that he really needs to get face to face with the people in this town and find out who this guy actually is. Right. So he learns that when he gets to Lockhaven, he learns that Aaron's never met his birth father, who's been in prison his entire life. He also learns that Aaron's stepfather, a man by the name of Eric Daniels, is also in prison. Daniels is in prison, pleading guilty to over 100 counts of child sex abuse, abuse that included members of his family. We find some things out later that will tell us even more there. But Zig learns that Dawn's brother, DJ, had been abused in a famous case in that area of a guy by the name of Dr. Barry Bender, who was providing major incentives of drugs and money to kids to perform acts in front of them and acts with them. And a number of victims got settlements in that case, but DJ was late to the party apparently and wasn't able to get a settlement. Ziegler would learn Josh Favell's story pretty early on about Dawn coming down and saying, I'm going to own that MF's house. He would also learn from Josh what happened to Josh following him doing an interview with Ziegler and him testifying at trial. He was threatened. He had a vehicle destroyed. He had other damage done to his property. And he had Dawn directly threaten him to not get involved or he would get hurt. And so Favell was pretty fearless in this thing all the way through it. There's a Therian Mock, who was Aaron's best friend at a younger age. They would have frequent sleepovers. Therian was one of the kids that was in that really bad car accident with Aaron that we learn about. And one of the things that was a big part of Aaron's story about what the abuse from Sandusky was doing to him was that, you know, he said it caused him to start wetting the bed, that he became a bedwetter as a result of his abuse from Sandusky. Well, Therian Mock tells us that Aaron was wetting the bed the entire time he knew him as a very young kid. So from age 8, long before he ever got involved or ever met Jerry Sandusky, Aaron was wetting the bed. So one of Aaron's main points to illustrate the effect that the alleged abuse was having on him was his bedwetting, when we find out that no, he's been bedwetting basically his entire life. He claimed to Chris Cuomo that he had been cutting himself and had become suicidal. Ziegler meets with another one of Aaron's friends, a guy by the name of Jamon Garrett. And Jamon says that is completely untrue, that he was, again, one of Aaron's best friends, shared a bunch of classes with him, saw his arms on a daily basis. There were never any cuts on his arms that he, in his opinion, would never have considered suicide. That wasn't him. Jamon also shared.
Real quick, so you don't get too confused. The cutting and the thoughts of suicide are not the same thing. Cutting is when people do it to themselves to relieve, but it's proven. They cut themselves in that instant when they're cutting, they're not thinking about the abuse or whatever bad shit happened to them. And a lot of times they'll hide it. They'll do it in places where you can't see it. You're not going to cut off. Now, I've seen a lot of them that have done it up and down their arms, but I've also seen it on legs and places like that. I'm not saying he did. I just wanted to clarify that.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, why are nearly one in three American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that doesn't turn into fat when you consume it. Instead, it turns into a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body.
So getting more MCTs in your diet is like flipping a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which flushes out excess fat and calories. And Dr. Gundry has created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it comes in a tasty drink form. It actually tastes good. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized.
So if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/RLRC and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. And again, that's GundryMD. .com/RLRC.
Awesome.
All right, good deal. Do you want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with a subject?
IXL now.
Is your child ahead, real life, not getting challenged enough in class?
Get an exclusive
IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool curriculum. It offers practice in math, English,
today.
Language arts,
visit
science, and social studies while adopting to each child,
to get the meeting them where they are. Program
plus,
out there
IXL
at the best
encourages
price.
Students to be curious and empowers them how to choose to learn. Now, Cindy used IXL in the classroom as a teacher and now uses it to homeschool our youngest son in the ninth grade. The videos are what she finds that benefits him most in math because he's a very visual learner. The perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum, IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational game lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving, and everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you're covering. Instant grading, helpful progress reporting. IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Flexible and personalized. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. It's fun for kids, and kids love IXL's positive feedback, awards, and educational games. And it's trustworthy. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Gotcha. Javon also shared that Aaron had claimed that he lost his virginity at age 12 and that he had had sex with over 300 girls.
And a lot of victims of sexual abuse are very promiscuous. And that's that they think that sex is a natural thing. Not the natural, that's not natural. They think that sex is the only thing. They become hyper-focused on sex.
Aaron was unaware that one of his closest friends, it's a different guy by the name of Dylan Emmel, had been abused by a family member when Dylan was just 7. So when it came out, by the way, Aaron threw out the trial, and this is all 2014, long after the Sandusky conviction. And Aaron has never told any of these guys who are his closest friends that he was a Sandusky victim. They don't know this. And so they find out, depending on which one we're talking about, in 2013, 2014, because the town of Lock Haven becomes increasingly aware of Ziegler's investigation and the Framing Paterno website that he had set up and all of this evidence that was coming forward. Dylan had no idea until he was made aware of the Framing Paterno site, and he went to Aaron and shared his story of being abused when he was 7. And in his interview with John Ziegler, he said that Aaron just, at the point that Dylan confessed to Aaron his abuse, Aaron just shut him completely down and out of his life. Didn't want to discuss it with him ever again. Different attempts to get together with him. Aaron wouldn't respond to messages. They basically, their relationship ended immediately after Dylan confessed to having been a victim of abuse. Then there's these two women. We'll hear about them in a much larger way in a future episode, but their names are Judy Fox and Heather Ellis. And Ziegler gets involved with them because they seek him out. They follow the case and the conviction of Sandusky, and then come to find out that a victim is in their hometown of Lock Haven, and he's written a book, and they decide they want to put on an event to help Aaron Fisher sell books. And so they organize this entire event, and Dawn Fisher gets involved with the event and spends a pretty significant amount of time around these women, and they seek John out to tell him that after spending the time that they've spent with Dawn, they no longer believe the story. They believe that this was all about money, that it was Dawn that was pulling Aaron's strings all the way along. They give a description of a lot of the things that that she has said and how she has behaved in the time with them. And in a nutshell, she was acting like a woman who had won the lottery, not the woman who had allowed her son to be abused 100 times by this serial child rapist. And so the last of the major people involved in Aaron Fisher's life that Ziegler meets with is Mallory Fisher, who was still his wife at the time in the process of divorcing Aaron. And so, yes, this is somebody who may have had bone to pick with Aaron, but also had some economic interests that she was kind of going against in talking with John in the way that she spoke with John. But she shared with John that she didn't believe any of Aaron's story. In fact, she did believe Aaron was abused. Aaron shared with her that he was abused. Only his abuser was Eric Daniels, the man who went to jail pleading guilty to over 100 counts of abusing children, the man who married his mother, who lived in the same house with him, who also abused his sister. And so when you consider that, you know, Fisher had this reputation as a bullshitter, the people in his school didn't believe him. His friends didn't believe him. His wife didn't believe him. There was nobody. Ziegler was trying to find somebody who would advocate for Aaron Fraser, somebody who would tell a story about why Aaron's story was likely credible. And there was no one. And so by the time this is, his visit is done, he is very much convinced that Fisher's a fraud, that he was never abused by Sandusky. And so if you are Ziegler now, you're looking at this and you're saying, okay, the cornerstones of this case in my mind as I got in were this story about the grad student McQueary having seen Sandusky having anal sex with a boy in a shower. We found out that that wasn't true. The other cornerstone is this kid who he supposedly abused over a period of years more than 100 times, and no one in the orbit of this kid believes him. And he's in this family where there was a serial abuser who's now in prison. There's an uncle who was abused. There's a mother who's telling the neighbor that she's in it for the money, and telling women that are organizing an event that she's in it for the money. He's now, holy shit, there's a chance that Sandusky's innocent. If neither of these cases are true, how do I know any other one is true? And so as we move forward into episode 7, we will meet several other victims of the case and see, in the case of every other victim, their story is pretty ridiculous and grow out of attempts to recruit victims to this case. This is what happens. The state has these three, and they leak to Sarah Ganim in March of 2011, the grand jury investigation into Sandusky, so that without her knowing, I mean, she's just a useful idiot, she is writing stories that they are hoping will bring new people with new stories to the table to enhance their case. And she is letting victim six's mother, Deborah McCord, this is Zach Constance's mother from the last episode, know that the case has fallen apart and she really needs to get on the stick if charges are going to get filed. And then we'll find out and we'll talk about these people. Three more victims who are close friends of Zach Constance end up coming into this as victims prior to November of 2011.
Yeah. Well, in totality, you know, you look at Aaron Fisher's story and you certainly could say, you know, he's full of shit or his mom was after the money or whatever. The grand jury thing about McQueary saying that he saw them saying that he said he saw anal penetration. If that wasn't true, then that charge should have never gone anywhere, right? And but anytime, especially somebody that's high profile or of any type of profile, gets on the news, you know, people are going to come out of the woodworks, and some of them may be true and some of them may not be true. And that's why it's investigated. And that's why we have jury trials. How many victims in court total? I know how many counts, but how many different victims?
So there are 10 at trial, but in two of the cases, the case of victim two, which is the boy in the shower, they don't have, even though we know who he is, for reasons we'll get into, he's not actually identified at trial. The government claims they don't know who he is. His name is never shared. And by the way, the reason that it ends up being 45 counts that he's convicted on instead of 48 is because they actually don't convict Sandusky of anything having to do with the McQuarrie incident. Right. So the thing that started the whole panic and created this entire case is the one thing they don't end up convicting the guy of, which is just unbelievably ironic.
They shouldn't have it, especially if they, I mean, I know you're saying about the governor and all that shit. He shouldn't have been convicted on that. If it's a lie, then that's the right call. You know, Aaron Fisher, is he full of shit? And did he cut himself? And the statement on 2020, you could always play that from both sides. I can't wait to get into it and hear more. But at the end of the day, what gets me, and I think it might help go to my point, and I'm still open-minded. Look, I did a child sex case last week for an attorney, and I cleared the guy. Okay, and so the what goes to my mind, if the jury did convict him on the other counts because they found that was bullshit, then why did they find such credibility come back unanimous for that? But we'll get into it, to convict him on all the counts they got him on. So
I want to answer your question. So about how many cases there were at trial. So there were for victim two, there is no victim two. And then in the case of victim eight, there is no victim eight. That's a fascinating story, which I can't wait to share with you. Even though there are 10 quote unquote victims, there's actually only eight people.
Yeah. I get it.
When it gets to trial.
One more thing, I'm going to say this, and don't take this the wrong way, but I learned this a long time ago. I used to have to tell younger detectives, one of them, I'm not going to say his name, doesn't matter. He's in the chief spot right now. And we interviewed this guy on a homicide case for, I don't know, a good homicide interrogation. And then he starts after 5 hours, you start breaking them down. But this shit went on for days. Not all at one time. He got to sleep and whatever, went back in. And fuck, I knew that he was lying, right? But my partner was like, called me out of the hallway on the second day. And he was like, man, I think I believe him that he's telling the truth. I said, motherfucker, you can't stop. You can't start believing the motherfucker because you're tired of disbelieving, right? We didn't have the proof at the point. And that's the same thing, like on the situation, the further you get into it and you make the personal connection with Sandusky, whether it's through the prison visit or the phone calls and the wife and what have you, I'm not saying that we'll get through the case, but you can't stop believing what's logical just because you're tired of disbelieving it, because you take these things and you can certainly have a personal bias when you're so far in. I'm not saying Zig did, but I'm talking about any case. When you so far in, you got this much time interviewing this many people, and then this, because there's one asshole over here and this was wrong, dah, dah, dah. It doesn't mean it's all wrong. But we're going to get into it, and that's what I find interesting. So,
yeah, it doesn't mean it's all wrong. And remember that the best thing that could ever have happened to John was to find something that indicated to him that Sandusky was guilty, because he didn't want to have to keep going with this. He wanted this to end. You actually be fascinated your opinion on this, because maybe this has been you on certain cases, or maybe this is people you know in certain cases in your history, but the case takes on a power over you where you have to know the truth, and your marriage is in trouble. Your family's in danger. I mean, he was getting death threats. All of this stuff is going on around you, yet you're not reacting to it. You're oblivious to it because you are in this just endless pursuit of the truth. And that's where he was. And so at this point, he's not ready to declare that Sandusky is innocent, but he sure doesn't think a lot of Aaron Fisher or his story. Right. He knows that McQuarrie was full of shit. And one of the things that I think is going to really be a gut punch for you as we get deeper into this is the behavior of these officers in this case. I mean, the amount of prosecutorial misconduct, the amount of misconduct by police, by two judges, that what went on in this state is unbelievable when you see it in its totality by the time we get to the end. This was a railroading of an innocent man. We're not there yet. Okay, all we know is we got a weird victim one who a lot of people seem to not believe, who's from a family where, you know, there's abuse in their history, and we got a guy whose story changed 500 times, but told his father he didn't see anything sexual, told his father's best friend he didn't see anything sexual, told Schultz he didn't see anything sexual, told Curley he didn't see anything sexual, and told Paterno he didn't see anything sexual, yet the state told everybody that he saw him having anal sex with a boy in a shower. Yeah. So it's a very effed up case at this point.
I concur. And we'll get into it, and we'll let everybody know what episode to listen to next so we can get it out, and I'll get it out.
Yeah, it'll be episode 7, which is about going after the finding the other victims. So we'll discuss a number of other victims and their stories in that episode 7.
Cool. Good deal.
All right, man.
All right.
Enjoy the rest of the week. Thank you, folks.
All y'all. Appreciate you, and continue to like and listen and share and tell everybody about it and all the good podcasts.
Right. Glad.
Peace.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.